Hi, this is Tilly Walton, and I'm host of Wild Rivers with Tilly on PBS, and you are listening to the Water Values Podcast.
The Water Values Podcast is sponsored by the following market-leading companies and organizations: by Black & Veatch, building a world of difference; by 120 Water, new rules need new tools; by 1898 & Co., possibilities powered by experience; by Woodard & Curran, high-quality consulting engineering, science, and operation services; by Intera, innovation and stewardship for a sustainable tomorrow; by Xylem, let's solve water; and by the American Waterworks Association, dedicated to the world's most important resource. This is session 253.
Welcome to the Water Values Podcast. This is the podcast dedicated to water utilities, resources, treatment, reuse, and all things water. Now here's your host, Dave McGimsey.
Hello and welcome to another session of the Water Values Podcast. As my daughter Sarah said, my name is Dave McGimsey and thank you for joining me. We have a terrific and important show for you today. Greg Pierce, a man with many titles, including Professor of Urban Planning at UCLA, Director of UCLA's Human Right to Water Lab, Director of UCLA's Water Resources Group, and Research and Co-Executive Director of UCLA's Luskin Center for Innovation, joins us for a discussion on water quality and water equity issues facing mobile home parks. As Greg says in the interview, if you care about small communities and water equity, you need to care about mobile home parks too. In any event, Greg delivers a terrific interview and relates some important information about water quality, infrastructure management, and more at mobile home parks. Plus, Reese Tisdale stops by for a Bluefield on Tap segment to discuss Eversource's recent announcement to divest Aquarian. Yes, that's a big one. And regardless, we have a good show for you today, so stay tuned. Well, as you know, we always say thank you to our awesome sponsors at the top of every show, and we have some fantastic sponsors this year. Our sponsorship lineup includes Black & Veatch, 120 Water, 1898 & Co., Woodard & Curran, Intera, Xylem, and the American Waterworks Association. And that, as I'm sure you are all aware, is a terrific collection of impactful companies that have affirmatively decided to support water industry thought leadership and education. And we thank you all. And I'd like for you, the listener, to please do me a favor. If you work for or with any of those sponsors, please thank your boss or thank your contact at the sponsor firm and let them know that you appreciate their leadership in the industry through the sponsorship. You'd be surprised how far that simple little note of thanks will go. And as long as you're letting sponsors know how much you appreciate their support of water industry education thought leadership, hey, why not leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whatever other podcast directory you're accessing the podcast on? It'd be greatly appreciated and will help others find out about the podcast. And also, please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Yes, the ever-important subscription. Thank you so much. Well, before we head on to the interview with Greg Pierce of UCLA, we've got a Bluefield on Tap segment with Bluefield Research's Reese Tisdale, who's discussing Eversource's recent announcement to divest Aquarian. So take it away, guys. Reese, welcome to another session of Bluefield on Tap. This is the maybe I should say this is the spring training version of Bluefield on Tap. So how you doing this month?
If you want to talk spring training, not so good. If you want to talk about the water industry and what's happening, I'm all ears.
What's going on in the water industry? What's caught your eye?
So last time we talked, we did talk about M&A, private water M&A in particular. But since then, there's been a big deal. And big deals, as I think we've talked about in the past, are hard to come by in the water sector. And by that, I mean acquisitions of utilities serving more than 100,000 people. So Eversource, it's going to put its position or ownership of Aquarian Water on the block. And so that's a big deal, and that's in the news.
Yeah, that's a huge deal. Convergence no more. I mean, let's talk about the deal. Let's talk about the deal. So what's going on with Eversource's divestment?
All right. So basically, Eversource, they've been taking some serious financial hits, and it's not really because of the water business. I think largely it has to do with their offshore wind investments. Eversource is basically a distributor and service provider. They sell basically gas and electricity, and that's really what their core business is. And over the last 5 to 10 years, they've gotten into other areas, including offshore wind generation. They made big investments. They're now getting out from under those. But they also got into the water sector in 2017. What does that mean? They, from Aquarian Infrastructure Partners, they acquired Aquarian Water for about $1.7 billion. And they, at the time, it was about 205,000 customers. So that's a significant deal. And quite honestly, and you're kind of alluding to this, is that we at Bluefield were really excited about it. One, because of the scale of the deal, but also because of a critical infrastructure player, an energy player in this case, buying a water utility where there are going to be some synergies and benefits to this acquisition. And it seems to not be the case.
Yeah. So this is the second big energy utility to kind of get out of water. So NextEra got out of water. Eversource is getting out of water. What does this mean? I mean, is history just repeating itself? Because is this like the late 90s, early 2000s all over again?
No, I think I'm still in on it. I'm gonna keep riding this train where there is an opportunity for convergence. I think the issue is the companies that buy into it need to kind of do something with it. So, I mean, stepping back, the NextEra deal, as we talked about, I mean, I think a big part of it was it's hard work to get into the water industry. The systems, the acquisitions are typically small. If you want to buy a big municipal utility, it's very, there's a lot of friction out there when it comes to dealing with city councils and mayors, politicians, and really the public as a whole. But NextEra got out of it partly because there was so much opportunity, whether it be because of the Inflation Reduction Act, or just renewables as a whole. That's really their core business. The case of Eversource, I think they were hoping for more to happen with it, but really nothing came of it. They really only made 12 acquisitions since they acquired it in 2017. But that being said, what we are seeing is NW Natural, the natural gas services provider in Oregon, has been really active. They're expanding into other states. So that's been happening. And also, I think, as I mentioned last time with you, that Algonquin, who owns Liberty Utilities, they're actually moving more into the regulated business. I would say doubling down. They basically said, in the U.S., we're going to get into regulated business, including the water sector. So I think the opportunity is still there for some convergence, but in this case, not so much.
All right. So Eversource is putting Aquarian on the block. Is there a buyer yet? Or who, if there's not, who are the potential buyers?
Well, as you can imagine, private equity, financial community is going to be really excited about this. There's a lot of capital out there that needs to be deployed. So dry powder, as they say. So I think that's definitely going to draw a lot of attention. So there, whether it be big players or not, most of the private equity players that we track now have mostly been focused on smaller players, like whether it be Science Capital, Ridgewood. That being said, Bernard Capital out of Louisiana, they were also, they're in the bid competition for JEA out of Jacksonville at one point. Maybe that was more for the power side, but there was a water business to be gained there as well. When it comes to the strategics, obviously the big player in Connecticut, which is where Eversource's largest footprint is. I think it's probably 85% of its customers are in Connecticut. So Connecticut Water, who's owned by JEA, or by SJW, excuse me, the acronym mix up. But SJW out of San Jose, California, they acquired Connecticut Water a while back. So they're obviously a player that could look at it. But then, there may be ways of selling off individual assets. Eversource is active in three states in New England. So Connecticut, Massachusetts, as well as a much smaller footprint in New Hampshire. So no buyers yet, but certainly a lot of interested parties.
Yeah. What about regulatory hurdles? Or is this going to require any sort of state regulatory approvals or anything like that?
Yeah, it's going to have to go through that whole process. It's going to take a little while. We're not, the biggest, I'd say, headache for any potential buyer is Connecticut, which is where Eversource and Aquarian specifically has been facing a fair amount of pushback from the regulator over a pending rate case. That it's actually Aquarian's first rate case, and I think and requested an increase in 10 years, but yet the regulator doesn't fully agree with not only the increase, but what's also included in it is for justification.
Got it. All right. Well, I'm very excited to see how this all shakes out. Very interested to see where Aquarian ends up. Thanks so much, Reese.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime. I like this stuff. So I look forward to next time we talk.
I'm sure we'll have more to talk about. All right, cool. Reese, as always, thanks for the knowledge. Appreciate it. We'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Cheers. Take care.
Bye. As always, great information from Bluefield Research and Reese Tisdale. Now it's time for the main event, our interview with Greg Pierce. So let's get that water flowing. Well, Greg, welcome to the Water Values Podcast. Great to have you on. How you doing today?
I'm doing great. Great to be on. I've listened to quite a few of these, so happy to be joining you today.
Terrific. Well, it's great to have you on. I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. But before we dive into the subject matter du jour, could you please give us a little snapshot of your background and how you came to the water sector?
Yeah, I'd say I didn't come too early in life. Basically got undergraduate degrees in economics and history, which was lovely, but realized I wanted to apply myself and really try to do some good in the world and was looking around for ways to do that. Started to get into international development a bit, and then have a friend who's still a civil engineer in water who said, maybe you should look at global water. I started looking at global water, particularly sort of water sanitation hygiene or wash access globally, and in some ways never looked back. I wound up doing graduate degrees, master's and PhD, really focused from the international development lens on water in urban areas in a few different low and middle income countries, especially in South Asia. But actually, in a way, got into migrating my interests back around water sanitation access in the U.S. through looking at mobile home parks, or discovering that mobile home parks were a big issue in that realm. But in the last decade or so, I've sort of refocused my work, but taking very similar approaches to what I did internationally, but refocused it back on the U.S., particularly California, but also sort of the broader spectrum, and seeing, especially with new momentum around solving water access issues in recent years, that the U.S. is a good lens and an important place to work in.
Excellent. So could you kind of set the stage for us? You identified mobile home parks, but why are those good? Why are mobile home parks a good barometer for looking at wash issues and water access and equity issues?
Yeah, first of all, I'd say want to say a little bit about what mobile home parks are. Mobile home parks are group living situations or settlements where you have a cluster of homes or mobile homes, manufactured housing, together. And it can really range from a few together to hundreds, rarely above hundreds. But there's quite a few mobile home parks across the U.S. In fact, around 6 to 7% of the U.S. population lives in the broader category of what's known as mobile homes or manufactured housing. About half of that is in mobile home parks. And it really varies. Actually, some parts of the Southeast, Midwest, the percentage of folks living in mobile home parks is much, much higher than that 6 or 7%. It's up in the 20s. Whereas in places like California, it's a relatively small percentage of the population. But that being said, mobile home parks are everywhere. There's 500 mobile home parks in LA County. And I would suggest if folks aren't familiar with them, just keep your eyes open as you're driving or, on transit to different places, and you'll start seeing them everywhere. And, I'd say why are we looking at mobile home parks and WASH? The answer is that a lot of small water systems, small regulated water systems, are actually run by mobile home parks. Again, in a place like California where we've done analysis, it's about 500 of the 3,000 quote-unquote community water systems, for those regulated by the EPA to provide drinking water service year-round. And in some ways, mobile home parks are emblematic just of the problems that we've seen and have been well documented, I think, on this podcast, among many other places, around, you know, the difficulties small regulated water systems have in providing safe, reliable, and affordable water service to their customers. And mobile home parks are sort of a subset of a broader category that's particularly problematic, which is small private systems. Not small or not investor-owned utility systems, but sort of ancillary systems, systems often run, again, in housing settlements of different kinds. But in other ways, mobile home parks stand out as being particularly problematic, partly because of the management issues and the, to use the social science term, sort of the agency issues involved in having residents who don't control their local infrastructure, whereas management is supposed to do so. But also, I think, you know, in addition to data analysis we've done and sort of looking at small water systems and the issues that they have, I've been struck over and over again by talking to regulators and advocates, you know, interested in solving WASH issues in the U.S., and how often mobile home parks just come up in conversation as a part of the problem and a big part of the population that we're trying to serve better.
Yeah. So you drew a distinction between mobile home parks and manufactured housing. And so based on my practice, I've been involved in some situations involving mobile home parks. And I just from the way the lens I've come at it from is kind of the mobile home park is there's a pad and there are hookups, whereas manufactured housing and some of those, it seems a little more permanent, even though it's manufactured. Am I characterizing those correctly?
I'd say yes and no. And I will say there's a lot of complexity, and housing scholars would dive right into that here. I'd say a few things here. First of all, very few quote unquote mobile homes are mobile at all, whether they're in a park or not. You know, there's RVs, but most modern, again, they go by synonyms, mobile home or manufactured housing. Once you park it, it's very hard to move it. I'd say the big distinction I'm aware of is that the mobile home parks are, they're regulated, usually regulated by housing departments in states, and they have, you know, the joint management, which is, you know, supposed to provide amenities, supposed to help with utility access issues. But in many cases, particularly when the parks run their own utilities, it winds up being quite a bit worse. But there's all sorts, I should say, of different combinations in mobile home parks of tenure situations. There's quite a few where residents own both the land and, you know, their housing unit, but just as many, I think, actually more, where mobile home park tenants only own the unit and not the land. And I suppose that's where the greatest distinction is compared to broader manufactured housing, where it's more common that folks will own both the land and the unit. But again, there's a lot more complexity there in that space. But I think that's as short of an answer as I can give.
Okay. That's perfect. So you've kind of mentioned that the issues pertaining to water equity are present in the mobile home park situation. Could you please dive into why is that? What is it about mobile home parks that create this water equity issue?
Absolutely. And there's really two tracks of that conversation. The first is the one we've been talking about, where mobile home parks run their own water system because they serve 15 or more connections. They qualify as a community water system. And in that case, really based on our study and plenty of other examples and studies, mobile home park run systems, again, much like the broader set of really small water systems, tend to do worse in terms of the dimensions of the human right to water. I tend to use the human right to water definition in California, which is similar to other human right to water definitions, but basically looking at quality, affordability, and accessibility. Mobile home park run systems do worse on all dimensions. Quality, it's quite easy to see when looking at the violation or the violation of the Safe Drinking Water Act data. Mobile home park run systems tend to violate more the health standards, monitoring, reporting standards. And when they have violations of health standards, those tend to be longer and more acute. And I will say as an aside, when we think about adding regulations for emerging contaminants, things like hexavalent chromium 123 TCP in California or PFAS everywhere, the challenge of providing quality in small systems gets even greater. That leads to the next challenge, which again is, I'd say, most pervasive across small systems. Even if they provide high quality water and accessible water, they pretty much all face technical, managerial, financial capacity challenges because they simply don't have economies of scale to provide the necessary treatment and infrastructure that your larger water systems do. So even if they're, you know, able to thread the needle on quality and reliability, they're always facing financial challenges just around the corner, and particularly with new regulations. I will say that we don't actually know a lot about what mobile home park residents pay for water, because that's almost universally embedded in what they pay for housing. There are certainly examples and anecdotes about really high payments for water service, but there's not systematic data on it because it's not required to be reported, and often they don't receive a separate water bill like most other folks. And then when it comes to reliability, I think mobile home park systems are, again, almost universally reliant on a single source. So they don't have source diversification. They rarely have interties into other systems, and it's almost always, at least in Western context, a single well source. And with climate change in particular, a lot of wells drying up, if that well gets contaminated, they're out of luck. And there's also quite a few issues that say more broadly with mobile home parks, but when it comes to mobile home park run water systems, even if they're close to another system or within a city, cities or other larger systems aren't always willing to help them out. Partly due to stigma issues, but also sort of broader concerns that if they help out, they become the de facto provider for that system. And if it's a city, also that they may be extending service, may be a pathway to annexation that the city is not in favor of. So all that being said, mobile home park run systems perform worse on the three dimensions of the human right to water. But I want to emphasize that actually most mobile home parks are served by larger water systems. They don't run their own system. But that doesn't mean that they're being provided residents or are being provided actual end-use water service like the rest of us. In particular, affordability is a big issue, or shutoffs are a big issue in mobile home parks that are served by larger water systems, but where a manager is responsible for paying the bill and maintaining the in-park infrastructure. There's case after case of mobile home park residents not receiving water for days, sometimes weeks, because the bill hasn't been paid by a manager. And in many cases, again, this can lead to cities getting involved, and in some cases, foreclosure of parks or threat of foreclosure, eviction, et cetera. So huge insecurity issues there, as well as quality issues, because the in-park pipes, all the in-park infrastructure, is really the responsibility of the management company or the manager, the owner of that park. And there can be a lot of issues that are, you know, more broadly seen in premise plumbing if you don't maintain your pipes, if you don't clean out your pipes. So case after case of pretty severe discoloration in particular of water quality coming out of people's taps, which may not technically be unsafe and violate the standards of the Safe Drinking Water Act, but it's obviously water that people don't want to drink, they don't trust. So that's, again, a high-level overview of the issues water access-wise facing both mobile home park-run water systems and folks served by larger water systems in mobile home parks. I do want to add, I said WASH, the sanitation is included too. It seems that there's probably just as big of issues with sanitation, again, relative to the broader population. In mobile home parks, a lot of mobile home parks are run on, you know, septic, or to use the technical term, on-site wastewater treatment systems. It's just that people haven't systematically studied it. But if you talk to, again, regulators who are looking at sort of folks who don't have basic sanitation, have sewage backing up into their showers, overflowing in their yards, mobile home parks, again, are high on the list of problem areas, really, both in California and across the U.S. It just hasn't been documented to the same extent as the water access issues, which is more broadly true of water access for sanitation in this country.
Yeah, that's interesting, because what the last segment you described is really my experience on the sanitation side, because I've been involved in some mobile home situations where the collection system was a vitrified clay pipe, and the inflow and infiltration issues were just driving up the flows that the sewer utility that served the customer, the mobile home park. And it just created an incredible financial burden on the mobile home park because of that vitrified clay pipe that had those INI problems.
Yeah, no, I guess I'll take the opportunity here to say it's not just water and sewer. It's also increasingly with climate change. If you look at studies around fire hazard, particularly deaths due to fire as well as heat, mobile home parks stand out there too. And that's, again, a combination of infrastructure issues. Electrical infrastructure, natural gas infrastructure is a big problem in these parks as well. The in-park infrastructure, as well as the spatial location of parks. Again, they're everywhere, but in metropolitan areas, they tend to be on the fringe, and thus, especially with fire, more prone to be in the wild and urban interface. So there's a lot of environmental hazards and utility infrastructure sort of deficiencies in these parks. But I also want to say, I should have said this up front, mobile home parks are quite affordable housing-wise compared to other types of housing. And we basically see, even in the same metropolitan area, you are generally going to pay about 60% to live in a mobile home park compared to what you pay for other types of housing. So that's the reason that folks live in them, and why we need to be concerned about preserving mobile home parks, because they do provide affordable housing, but again, come with these other disamenities or hazards.
Yeah. So can you dive into a little bit, and I think you touched on it, but I just want to clarify, why do mobile home parks have the quality problems? I think one of the things you said was, look, if it's a single source, if they've got their own well, so they are the provider. Well, that could explain it. But what about the systems that are connected to a larger water utility? What is causing the water problems in that situation?
Yeah, my understanding is, and I should say, I'm not an engineer, I'm a social scientist through and through, but I do a lot of work. We do a lot of work on tap water trust. And basically, in mobile home parks served by larger systems, the issue comes down to what's known in the industry as premise plumbing. And all the pipes from the edge of the mobile home park lot line and in the interior are the responsibility of whoever owns the park. And the water can be perfectly fine coming from the larger water system's distribution network into the park, but can become contaminated by the pipes and the, you know, the fixtures in actual units, and that's lead to quality problems. Again, it doesn't mean that the water's unsafe necessarily. Premise plumbing, certainly there's volatile organic compounds that can be introduced by poorly maintained premise plumbing, but for the most part, it's issues of discoloration, tasting bad, smelling bad, that are in the Safe Drinking Water Act's eyes, quote unquote, secondary contamination problems, but they are the things actually that people notice the most, and rationally, again, if the water is quite discolored, in particular, don't trust that water, won't drink that water, but most of those issues are introduced by the plumbing or the pipes and the fixtures that are the responsibility of management. And a lot of the issue with mobile home parks that I haven't perhaps drawn out is that I've never heard of a mobile home park that has an individual who's just responsible for a water system. Almost always the person who's responsible for a water system is a single person and is responsible for maintenance and upkeep of all of the park's infrastructure and other aspects. In many cases, they're responsible for multiple parks' infrastructure and overall management, or the mobile home park contracts out with a roving operator or sort of manager fixer of water systems who might be responsible for 5 to dozens of water systems, so isn't on site all the time, isn't able to give a full eye to these issues because of the economics of the park and the economics of that infrastructure. But I hope that gives a little bit more clear sense of why there's quality issues even when these parks are connected into larger systems.
Yeah, I think you've done a great job, Greg, laying out the issues. Let's talk about the solution. Right. So are you seeing anything out there in terms of solving these problems, or at least trying to solve these problems?
Yeah, I think there is growing attention to the issues of environmental hazards, in particular water, but also, I'd say, fire, a little bit of heat in mobile home parks. And there are a number of potential solutions to the water issues in mobile home parks. I mean, the first and broadest, again, isn't not specific to mobile home parks, but there is historic funding for water systems through the bipartisan infrastructure law that's routed through through the each state's drinking water state revolving fund for upgrades. A lot of that money is going to small disadvantaged water systems, including mobile home parks, to upgrade the capital infrastructure, particularly treatment systems, to address contamination issues. That being said, there's a lot of concern, at least that I'm hearing, around throwing good money after bad. And if you upgrade the infrastructure, put in a great treatment system, but you don't have someone who has the technical training to operate it, or you don't have the money for that park, again, to pay in to maintain that system, that's not a great investment. But that's one of the answers. Certainly, again, the most common answer that we still have. I'd say we need to go in the direction of, and you're starting to see some states go in the direction of, enabling point of use, point of entry water quality treatment systems in places like mobile home parks. I think we need to recognize that really small systems can't manage large treatment systems, and we need to get creative about sort of loosening regulations carefully and allowing and supporting point of use, point of entry treatment where large capital infrastructure is impossible and where consolidation, which I'll talk about in a second, also isn't possible. More holistically, the answer certainly for a lot of parks, particularly parks that are near city boundaries or sort of donut hole systems in larger water systems, is consolidation into those larger systems. course, there's a big push or momentum toward the benefits of water system consolidation in the U.S. Again, I don't know if I said the number earlier, but we have 50,000 public water systems, I think community water systems in the U.S. There's a lot that needs to be done to consolidate the systems to provide human right to water and water security benefits. And we're seeing some of that, mobile home park system consolidation, certainly in the broader consolidation efforts and push. Again, there is a little bit of a particular holdup with mobile home parks in cases I've seen, just around the stigma that some folks have toward mobile home parks. I won't use any derogatory terms here, but there are plenty thrown out around mobile home parks in broader society. But in particular, cities hesitant to extend service to mobile home parks if they think that's going to then obligate them to annex parks entirely. But that being said, water system consolidation is probably the biggest, most permanent answer I see to small mobile home park water system issues. But I also think we potentially need to be more creative, again, because many of these parks are facing not just water, they're facing sewer, they're facing fire, potentially heat, energy and security issues. That really necessitates, I think, a whole of EPA or whole of Housing and Urban Development Department type approach. There's been some discussions about those types of approaches at the state level, but no one's really committed, I think, to trying to tackle these issues holistically across environmental sectors for parks. And then perhaps the final answer I'd give or option, which is, I think, promising but is yet to scale, is in parks that are managed by large management companies or just by absentee landlords, transitioning those parks toward being resident-owned is a potential solution. We're seeing it happen more, particularly through the efforts of organizations like ROC USA or Resident-Owned Communities USA. And I do think there's some promise there, although also some potential risks there with the need for basically volunteer groups in parks to raise the capital to, again, invest in infrastructure and do that sort of capital planning over the long term. But that where residents want that to happen, I think that's a great answer if they're willing to take on that responsibility. And then I maybe close by saying that there again are more creative potential solutions, at least to parts of these problems. You see designated efforts in places like New Hampshire, Vermont, Ohio, and then most interestingly to me, just last year, the state of Colorado took on the issue of water quality in mobile home parks in the most decided way I've seen anywhere, and passed a bill requiring that water quality be tested specifically in every mobile home park in the state, and has also dedicated some funds to remediation of the issues that they are likely to find. That being said, that the bill's been passed, the program has yet to get off the ground, but there is momentum toward, you know, addressing these issues. And I think we need to get both use the tools we have in the toolbox, as well as get more creative and invest the resources in programs like Colorado's just launching.
Terrific. Well, Greg, you have been absolutely fantastic. I've learned a lot because I didn't know much. So that you're painting on almost a near blank canvas here. So thank you so much for coming on. Do you have a leave behind message, or what would you want to leave the listeners with?
Yeah, I think my leave behind message would be, if you care about small communities, if you care about the problems, particularly climate change facing small systems, or if you care about affordable housing, you should really care and pay attention to the issues facing residents of mobile home parks. And secondly, again, there is some growing attention to the issues and hazards facing mobile home park residents, but we need to do more, and particularly we need to do more quickly to get ahead of the curve on the profound issues that really we're all facing due to climate change, but particularly small rural communities and mobile home parks in particular.
Great. Well, Greg, Thanks so much. For those who want to find out more about you and your work, where can they go to get that information?
Yeah, a few different places. First, you can email me, gspierce@ucla.edu. I am still on Twitter/X, at Greg S. Pierce. I'm on LinkedIn. And then you can go, I would direct you to the Luskin Center for Innovation website at UCLA, which is the URL. A, you can Google it, but the URL is innovation.luskin.ucla.edu.
Great. Well, Greg, thanks again. You were fantastic today. Really appreciated your time. And we'll talk again soon. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Abe. Take care.
Bye. Wow. I learned a lot during that interview, and I hope you did too. Greg is such a great resource and is doing such important work drawing our attention to issues like WASH in mobile home parks. So much appreciated, Greg. Thank you so much. Well, I'd love to know what you thought about the interview. Please check out the show notes page for information and links on this episode. Just Google the Water Values Podcast and click the first link that comes up. As longtime listeners know, that will take you to our landing page on the Bluefield Research website. Again, Bluefield Research and the Water Values LLC are not affiliates. We just have a joint marketing arrangement. And as part of that, hey, Bluefield Research is kind enough to give the Water Values podcast a home on the web. You can also email me at david.mcgimsey@dentons.com, and you can sign up for the newsletter at that landing page I mentioned earlier as well. Well, thank you again for tuning in, and I hope you make it a great day. Plus, I want to give a huge thank you again to our fantastic sponsors. Those sponsors include Black & Veatch, 120 Water, 1898 & Co., Woodard & Curran, Intera, Xylem, and the American Waterworks Association. The show would not be possible without those great companies and industry leaders, and I thank you all. And again, thank you for listening and for subscribing to the Water Values Podcast. Your support is truly appreciated. In closing, please remember to keep the core message of the Water Values Podcast in mind as you go about your daily business. Water is our most valuable resource, so please join me by going out into the world and acting like it.
Listening to the Water Values Podcast. Thank you for spending some of your day with my dad and me.
Well, thank you for tuning in to the disclaimer. I'm a lawyer licensed in Indiana and Colorado, and nothing in this podcast should be taken as providing legal advice or as establishing an attorney-client relationship with you or with anyone else. Additionally, nothing in this podcast should be considered a solicitation for professional employment. I'm just a lawyer that finds water issues interesting and that believes greater public education is needed about water issues. And that includes enhancing my own education about water issues, because no one knows everything about water.